Okay, so what were they? Constellation A, Little Dipper is fine. Constellation B, yep, Constellation C. Had we done Pegasus already? I couldn't remember. So Little Dipper, Hercules, and Pegasus. So Pegasus was not a double dipper. I think it'll be for 4 points each, but it might be for 3 points each. Last one was for three, but the question is whether to increase it to infinity or not. Questions? So we've got an exam on Friday, so typically schedule some sort of session where we can get together as a group. Typically at kind of 4 p.m. or kind of after dinner-ish. Typically the day before or the day before the day before the exam, so typically either Wednesday or Thursday. And we vote. Wednesday at 4. So Wednesday, is there agreement on that?
Yes.
So those for 4. It sounded impressive originally. One, two. So 4 and sometime in the evening. I don't know if 7 is going to be appropriate because it'll be still light at 7 now. So who's for 4? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And who's for 7, 8? Okay, so it's 4. So we did the last constellation quiz. We're moving on to planets today. That'll be the last chapter that'll be on the exam. So kind of in broad terms, we're talking conservation laws, light, telescopes, and today and a little bit of tomorrow, planets. Best way to study for the exam is to look at the old exam. So probably 75% of the Astronomy 212 exam is relevant, and probably 100% of last year's exam for 211 is relevant. I think we reached about the same place, but I guess I haven't actually checked. So do the old exam, bring it in, have me talk to you about your answers. That's, I think, the best way of doing it. There should be webcasts for all of those, for both of those exams that would also give you answers. Going. So we spent a lot of time last time on the big quiz. Questions on the big quiz? I think it was worth 40 points. And then we spent some time playing with lenses. And the upshot was a bunch of equations. I'm not sure exactly what the right order to talk about them is. So the aperture is the diameter of the lens. And a very important number is the F number, and that's the focal length divided by the diameter. So that begs the question of what the focal length is. So the focal length is the distance from the lens to the focused image. So to do that, you didn't look through the lens, you just tried to get a focused image of these light bulbs on the tabletop, and then you measured the distance from that focused image to the lens. And what you should have seen is that the lens that had the biggest image on the table, that one came with the lens that had the bigger focal length, the longer focal length. And the lens that had the brightest image was the one that had the smallest F number. So small F number, that means a bright image, which practically speaking means a short time exposure. And the size of the image on the film, which is about the same thing as magnification, that goes along with the larger focal length. Now, technically speaking, magnification isn't how big the image is on the film, it's how much bigger it looks like when you're using your eye. So you compare what something looks like with the eye that's looking through the telescope to what the eye is that's not looking through the telescope. And how much bigger, how much closer does the object look? That's what the magnification is. And the magnification is the ratio, it turns out, of the focal length of the objective to the focal length of the eyepiece. And that's one of the reasons there are lots of reasons why it's the least important property of a telescope. For, I guess first and foremost, you don't look through telescopes anymore, you take pictures pretty much. The other reason is that you can change it pretty easily just by swapping eyepieces. So kind of why make a big deal out of it? Since you choose a different eyepiece, you can get a different magnification. And I think I commented in the past that the atmosphere for visible light pretty much automatically blurs things by about an arc second, and your eye automatically blurs things by about an arc minute. So a magnification of about 60 or maybe 120, something like that, is about all that's useful. If you're getting more magnification than that, then all you're doing is making bigger fuzzy images. You're not actually seeing any more actual detail. When you made your telescopes, you separated the long focal length thing from the short focal length thing, and your eye was here. And you got a magnification that is pretty hard to judge, but roughly speaking, should have been the ratio of the objective to the ratio to the focal length of the eyepiece. Questions? Okay, well, planets. Planets are what we start today. So chapter 7 is kind of an overview of planets, and it's filled with tables that kind of look like this. Make sure you memorize all these numbers, not. The upshot is we're trying to put some sort of perspective on all of this data, and not trying to memorize all of these numbers by kind of putting things together into patterns that kind of make more sense than all of these sorts of numbers. So kind of the first thing to recognize is, as we talked about, I think on the very first day, the difference between an extensive variable and an intensive variable. So an extensive variable was one that got bigger when you were talking about more stuff. And because the size of an object may be somewhat accidental, it's usually not a particularly important property. Whereas the intensive properties, the ones that when you have more aren't necessarily more, those are kind of more intrinsically interesting. So in terms of the extensive variables, kind of the ones you can think of immediately for planets are going to be something to do with the size or the mass of the planet. So I might say the radius or the mass. We might be thinking about the orbit. What's the size of the orbit? Right, so usually we measure that in the semi-major axis. In terms of intensive properties, things that are maybe more characteristic of planets, you remember one of the first things we did is we looked at a ratio of the mass to the volume of a planet, and that was the density. So the thing that makes a pound of lead different from a pound of feathers is the density of that material, right? Lead is going to be a whole lot more dense. That is to say, the same weight will be in a much smaller volume. So this is just the ratio of two extensive ones. We talked about the temperature. So temperature is kind of the kinetic energy per particle. And another kind of intensive variable might be the composition. Right? Seawater is, I think, something like 4% salt. Doesn't matter whether you have a glass of seawater or an ocean of seawater. That composition is kind of an invariant quantity. So the intensive ones are generally more interesting because they tell us things that are different from just more is more. But it turns out that the main separation we're going to make between the planets is pretty much based on the overall size of the planets. So we're going to distinguish two, three types of planets. We've got planets that are more or less like the Earth, that are made basically of rock. Those are the terrestrial planets. Terrestrial is just a fancy word for Earth-like. And we have planets that this chart is calling gas giant planets. Our book calls these Jovian planets, named after Jupiter. Our book objects to the term gas giants because it says that the gas is really under really high pressure, so maybe liquid giants would be a better word. And what happened, I don't know, 5 years ago, is Pluto, which for 50 years or so had been a planet, was demoted into what's called, well, it still is a planet, but now it's a dwarf planet. And we have these objects that are, oh, a little bit smaller, comparable to the size of our moon. Since they're so small, I guess, well, it's one of the reasons they've been, as I say, demoted. So technically speaking, according to the International Astronomical Union, Pluto is not a planet. It's not a main planet. It's now a dwarf planet. So I guess it is still a planet of some sort. So we have a bunch of these objects which have kind of comparable sizes. And according to this chart, Eris is actually a little bit bigger than Pluto, but I think there's been a recent remeasurement of Eris, and it's actually smaller than Pluto. So the Pluto still seems to be the one that's closest to the edge of being a kind of a planet. And one of the reasons I think they got rid of Pluto is that they didn't want grade school kids to memorize this long a list, right? They figured that eight was enough planets for them to memorize. And I think probably even applies to college students. We're mostly going to be interested in the terrestrial planets and the gas giant planets. We're also going to be interested a lot in the big moons. So there are seven big moons so I'm not sure if it's on this table or not. So according to this chart, Jupiter has 66 moons and Saturn has 62 moons. I mean, they have huge numbers of moons that depend on the most recent news story. But they really don't, most of those moons are pretty small potatoes. So Jupiter has four big moons, Saturn has one big moon, we of course have one big moon. There are, roughly speaking, seven of these larger moons that we're going to spend some attention to also. Okay, so a big division is between gas giants and terrestrial planets. What's the difference? So in our solar system, the gas giants are the ones that are out far from the sun, and they are the ones that are big. And kind of that's traditionally what people figured. In order to form a big planet, it had to be out far enough where the gases could condense and form a big planet. But we now have on the order of 1,000 planets that aren't part of our solar system, and lots of them are things that are like Jupiter but are close to the star. So kind of have to rule out that as a characteristic of the Jovian planets. So we're talking about planets then that are basically big and that don't have a solid surface. Hence the name gas giants. So if you dropped a rock, the rock would go all the way to the center of the planet, and it's pretty hot there, so it would probably evaporate on its way down. But there's nothing that you could land on in one of these gas giant planets. Gas or liquid all the way down. Of course, in contrast to planets like the Earth, where we've got a perfectly good rocky surface. Now, one way of measuring the fact that they're basically gas is by looking at something that is intrinsically different between solids and gases. Right? So gases have a relatively low density, and that's going to be true of these Jovian planets. They have a density that is comparable to water. So Saturn has a density that's actually less than water. Jupiter has a density that's more than water. Approximately speaking, like water, which doesn't mean they're made out of water because the gas is highly compressed. Whereas the terrestrial planets, they have a density that's roughly like rock. And you know, rock sinks, so we're talking about things that are more dense than water. So roughly speaking, something like five times that of water would be typical for the density of these sorts of planets. So if we look at this huge column of numbers, here's the column that gives us the density of materials. And water, in these units, water has a density of 1,000. And I'm not sure what you were taught in high school, but I was taught that water had a density of 1 gram per cubic centimeter. But these are kilograms per cubic meters. So it turns out that 1 in these units is 1,000. So here we have Mercury, Venus, Earth, all having densities of about 5 times that of water, Moon being noticeably less, Mars being noticeably less. But that's in contrast to these other planets. And again, Pluto, no longer a planet. By this chart, incidentally, was stolen from the website of NASA. NASA has a probe that's going out to Pluto. So when it was launched, Pluto was a planet. And it'll take it a while to get out there, and it's not going to be a planet when it gets out there. But they certainly, they want to leave Pluto on the list since they're spending millions of dollars to go out there and a large amount of time. So in any case, you can see these sorts of densities. Saturn, a density less than that of water. These other ones, 30%, maybe as much as 60% more than that of water. Okay. And also just in terms of size, I guess I don't have these things exactly for comparison. These guys are way smaller than these guys. So we can see that in terms of their diameter. Here's Jupiter and here's Earth. Roughly speaking, Jupiter is 10 times bigger than the Earth in terms of its radius. And since volume goes like radius cubed, it's going to have 1,000 times the volume of the Earth. Not quite 1,000 times the mass of the Earth, of course, because it has a lower density, basically because it's a gas giant sort of planet. So Jupiter and Saturn have pretty comparable physical sizes, but noticeably different masses. And that goes along with being a gaseous planet. You can have pretty big differences in the size just depending upon the pressure that's present. So in terms of extensive and extensive variables, we had the semi-major axis, which is basically the distance the planet is from the sun, as an extensive variable. An equivalent intensive variable for the orbit is the shape of the orbit. You remember that these orbits are ellipses, so we can look at the eccentricity. And if you remember, 0 is a circle, and 1 is a very flat, basically line orbit. And if we look at the eccentricities of the planets, orbital eccentricities, let's leave Mercury out for the time being. Notice that they're all pretty small. And again, remember, Pluto is out. So in terms of the eccentricities, aside from Pluto and Mercury, all of these orbits are quite circular. And the one that is least circular of what's left over is Mars. So you might remember that it turns out that Mercury is very difficult to observe because it's always close to the sun. So the ancients were really off in a lot of respects on the orbit of Mercury. The next, and of course, Pluto wasn't discovered when Kepler was around. So Mars was the right one for Kepler to be discovering that the orbit wasn't exactly circular. But you remember by eye, all of these guys look very much like circles. It's just a matter of whether the sun is at the center of that circle or not, depending upon whether the eccentricity is noticeably small or not. Okay. So how about spin? How do these planets vary with spin? So one way of measuring the spin of a planet is how long it takes it to go around. And notice that for the Jovian planets, I'll talk about the minus sign in a second, we're talking about things that are a fraction of a day. So generally speaking, the Jovian planets are faster rotators, and since they have a physically bigger size, the equatorial velocity is way faster for these Jovian planets than it is for the terrestrial planets. So for the Earth and Mars, it's pretty much the same, roughly speaking, 24 hours. And for Venus and Mercury, it's long. So what's the minus sign about? So the minus sign is about whether these planets are spinning in the same direction they're orbiting or whether they're spinning in the opposite direction they're orbiting. So to get, if this is the Sun and this is the orbit of the Earth is orbiting that way, which is given a positive direction for the spin. If the Earth were spinning the other way, then we'd get a negative number. Now the actual axis of the, you know, the, what star the polar axis is pointing to, it doesn't have to be pointing exactly up or down. And if we look at the axial tilt, so here we have the 23.5 degrees for the Earth, not that different for Mars. Going along here, here's Uranus, which has an angle that's more than 90 degrees. So this is a planet that is spinning pretty much so that it's spinning like that as it orbits the Sun, with its spin axis in the same plane as the orbital axis. It's a little bit over tilted, so we have an extra 7 degrees, and it's that extra 70 degrees which makes the difference between a plus sign and a minus sign for that planet. Okay, but Venus is pretty much rotating nearly 180 degrees tilt, which is to say pretty much the same polar axis as the Earth has, but spinning the opposite direction very, very, very slowly. Okay, so generally speaking, fast spins for the Jovian planets. Uranus is the odd guy out because it's rotating backwards. Venus and Mercury are very much odd guys out because they're spinning so slowly. Here's the Moon, which of course isn't a planet, but you know that it's spinning as fast as it's orbiting, right? Because it's keeping the same face towards the Earth. So in one orbit, it must make one spin if it's going to keep the same face towards the Earth. So this is basically a month for its rotational period. A kind of a hint about what's going on for particularly Mercury, but it's not exactly correct, is that what we have are tidal forces between the planet and the Moon, in the case of our Moon, that are going to try and put the heavy side of the Moon towards the Earth. That's going to be the stable situation. So these sort of tidal forces are things that try and slow down the spin of things that are very close to the centrally orbiting object, and that's kind of what's going on in Mercury, but not exactly the case. But certainly Mercury and the Moon are highly affected by the tidal force, and we think that that explains the slow rotation. Venus is far enough away from the Sun that we don't think the tidal force is what's causing this, and it's an anomaly that isn't well explained, at least currently. Escape velocity. How fast do you have to go before you can actually escape the planet? So remember that we said that the orbital speed depended upon the mass and Newton's gravitational constant and the distance you were from the center of the planet. And roughly speaking, the orbital speed was the square root of g times the mass of the planet divided by the distance you are from the center. And the escape velocity was just the square root of 2 times that number. And of course, for a massive planet, we're going to have huge escape velocities, so it's pretty hard to launch your rocket from the, of course Jupiter doesn't have a surface to launch it from, in comparison to launching, oops, I'm looking at the wrong number. Here's the escape velocity for Earth, here's the escape velocity for Jupiter. Okay, so larger planets are hard to escape from. And now the other thing that kind of goes along with this is the terrestrial planets pretty much have small potato moons. So the moons of Mars are really small. They hardly count as moons. We've got a really big moon, and that's kind of an anomaly when we look at all of the terrestrial planets as a whole. In contrast, remember Pluto is not actually a planet these days. In contrast, the Jovian planets all have lots of moons. In some sense, they have an infinite number of moons because they all have ring systems. So I'm sure you're familiar with the rings of Saturn. What's going on there is we have zillions of icebergs that are orbiting around Saturn in pretty much the same plane at approximately the same radius. And all of those things, technically speaking, are moons. So in some sense, we have an infinite number of moons for anything that has a ring, and all of the Jovian planets have rings. In the case of Saturn, yes. So first of all, that's an excellent point, because we'll use this word ice sometimes to denote material that is not ice but has a melting point that is not that different from ice. So carbon dioxide, sometimes called dry ice, it has a pretty substantially lower melting point than water, but it might count. But more like things like ammonia that are kind of similar to it. Sometimes we'll call those things ices, in contrast to things like nitrogen and oxygen, which take really low temperatures before they condense. But yes, in the case of Saturn, we're talking about water ice bergs going around those guys. In the case of Jupiter, it probably isn't literally ice that's making up the ring of Jupiter. So first of all, the ring of Jupiter is different from all of these rings are actually a little bit different, but Jupiter's ring is kind of the plunkiest ring of all of them. And it's probably mostly dust as opposed to anything big enough to be called an iceberg. And it's probably hot enough that ice would evaporate. So generally speaking, ice, literally water ice, is the component that's making up the bulk of these rings, with the exception of Jupiter. And of course, no rings for us or any other sort of terrestrial planet. Magnetic fields. So Jovian planets are 100% yes. Terrestrial planets are 50% yes. So what's involved in making a magnetic field? Right, so this is why compasses work, right? So approximately speaking, and I'll correct myself in a second, inside the Earth, there's a big bar magnet. And if you think about it, it has to have a south pole in the north pole and a north pole in the south pole, because the pole that we call north on Earth is attracted to it, right? So if we have a little compass and it has a little N, it's going to be attracted to it, so the Earth's pole has to be a south pole. So there are a couple of things that are worth commenting about on this. And the first comment maybe to make is that this is a changeable situation. We'll learn when we talk about the Earth is that the poles on the Earth, on kind of a million-year time scale, reverse. So a million years from now, your compass, instead of pointing north, may point south. And it seems to be a pretty random process. The other thing that's true is that we know that there can't literally be a bar magnet inside of the Earth. So the Earth is made of iron, the core of the Earth is made of iron, which sounds good if you want to make a magnetic field. But it turns out that the magnetic ability of a material disappears at high temperature. So there's what's called the Curie temperature. That's Madame Curie's husband. It turns out that at high temperatures, higher than the temperature inside your oven, about 500 C, iron loses its ability to react to magnetic fields, and it becomes kind of like wood. So it isn't the source of the magnetic field inside the Earth or any of the other planets. So the only other way we know how to make magnetic fields, I'm sure you've seen these pictures of these big magnets that pick up cars. Those are things that you can control, and they're made by having an electrical current that's going around in a loop. So there must be a big electrical current many amps that is flowing in the electrical conductor that is iron and is making the Earth's magnetic field. Well, that seems like kind of a funny statement, because at least for us, if you unplug something, the current stops pretty quickly. So it's pretty clear that no one's paying the bill to get all this current flowing through the Earth, but it must somehow or other be, somebody must be paying the bill some way or other in order to get this electrical current running. And that seems to be the case with all of the planets. All the planets that have magnetic fields don't have them because they have bar magnets inside of them. They have them because they have electrical currents that are flowing through the insides. And of course, in order to have an electrical current, we need to have an electrical conductor. Something like copper is a great electrical conductor. Silver is a better electrical conductor. Gold is a pretty good electrical conductor. All those things are pretty rare. So at least for the terrestrial planets, it's probably iron, which is only a moderately good electrical conductor that is probably responsible for those magnetic fields. Composition. So if we go back to this other table, here we go. We have the composition of the atmosphere. So first of all, that's all there is, right, for the giant planets. In the case of Venus, we can't see to the surface, at least with visible light, so all that could be immediately measured was the composition of the atmosphere. Of course, it's easy to measure the composition of the Earth's atmosphere. It's mostly nitrogen with 20% oxygen mixed in. You can see that the other two terrestrial planets that have an atmosphere, namely Mars and Venus, have a primarily carbon dioxide atmosphere. And you may know that people are trying to prevent more carbon dioxide from building up in our atmosphere, the process of global warming, something we'll talk about much more in the future. So there's a big difference between the composition of the terrestrial planets and the compositions of the Jovian planets. So here it's hydrogen and helium. Incidentally, this is pretty normal for the universe as a whole. The most common element in the universe is hydrogen, and the second most common element in the universe is helium. And that's what the sun is mostly made out of. So in some sense, it's no surprise that these guys are made out of the most common element. So what really needs to be explained is why we don't have those elements here on Earth. And that's going to be kind of a long story, because we're going to need to bring in this idea of temperature. So a moment ago I said that probably the temperature at the where the rings of Jupiter are above the point where ice could exist. How can I make that sort of calculation? How can we get a handle on what the temperature is? So what determines the temperature? Well, I think it's pretty obvious that how close you are to the fire is certainly going to be one important property. Another important property is how big the fire is. If you think about it, the color of the clothes you're wearing also have an effect, right? Black seems to get hotter than white. So how do we mix all of these things together to get some sort of formula which can tell us what the temperature is of some object that's sitting in space? Now, I use that term temperature, and I have to be a little bit careful. What temperature? What's the temperature of the Earth? Right? So if I go up, it gets cold. If I go down, it gets hot. Maybe I'm talking about the surface temperature, but the Jovian planets don't have a surface, so I better not be talking about the surface temperature. And so what I mean by the temperature of an object, it's the temperature of the surface that is emitting the light. So remember, we said that every object that has a temperature is in fact incandescent. So we don't think about the walls in this room as emitting light. If I turn off the light, it looks black if I look at a wall. But in fact, they're emitting infrared light all the time. Every object that has a temperature is emitting light. If we look at an object, if we're deep inside of that object, the light that that piece is going to emit isn't going to go very far before it's absorbed by the remaining material. But if we're close enough to the surface, the light has a chance to actually escape. So when I'm going to talk about the temperature, it's going to be the temperature of the surface that's actually emitting light. So if we're talking about something like an asteroid that doesn't have an atmosphere, then we're talking about the surface temperature of the asteroid. If we're talking about something like Jupiter that has clouds but is very hot in the inside, we're going to be talking about the temperature of the clouds. And it turns out the Earth is kind of an in-between situation. Some of the light from the surface of the Earth does reach the great outdoors, so we have some temperature of the surface. But a lot of the light that the Earth emits is coming not from the surface, but from a few kilometers up, maybe 10 kilometers up. And all these same sort of considerations apply to the sun. So when I talk about the sun being about 6,000 degrees hot, the center of the sun is way hotter than that. It's like 15 million degrees hot. So I'm talking about the temperature of the piece of the sun whose light we're actually seeing, the so-called surface of the sun. But sun, like the gas giant planets, is gaseous all the way down. You dropped a rock there, and if it held together, it would happily sink to the bottom. Well, how do we talk about the incandescent light that is produced by an object that has a temperature, which is to say any object? Well, what we said is that this strongly depends on temperature. Right? You remember we said that the amount of light emitted from an object depended on the temperature to the fourth power. If we fill in all of the ifs, ands, or buts, the total power emitted depends on one of these universal constants, kind of like Newton's capital G. It's called the Stefan-Boltzmann constant. So the Stefan-Boltzmann constant, temperature to the fourth, times the area that is emitting that light. Right, so you might remember that the kind of toaster element looked dim, but it had a lot of surface elements, so it was actually emitting a fair amount of light, whereas the filament in the incandescent bulbs has a very small surface area, but is at a very high temperature, and it's actually emitting pretty much the same amount of light power by itself. So if we think about something like so here's now in this picture the sun, and here's, I'll call it the Earth, but it can be any old planet or any piece of rock or any dust particle. How much of the power of the sun is actually going to be absorbed by the Earth? Well, we know that all of the power of the sun is streaming through a sphere that has a radius that is the distance that the planet is from the sun. And only a tiny fraction of that is going to be intercepted by the Earth. And that fraction is just the ratio of areas, right? So we have the area of this big sphere sitting underneath the area of the interception area of the Earth. So the fraction of the power that we're going to collect that's going to be the area that that the light can intercept. So that's the area of a circle is pi r squared. The plus sign in a circle is the symbol that represents the Earth. Divided by the surface area of a sphere, which maybe you learned in high school is 4 pi r squared. So the total power that's heating the Earth, we can calculate then. The total input power, that's going to be the power that we get from the sun times the surface area of the sun. And we get a fraction of it. A fraction that is equal to the radius of the Earth divided by the surface area squared. Okay, so kind of putting the pieces together, this is the total amount of energy emitted per square meter of the surface of the sun. This is the number of those square meters, so that's the total power emitted by the sun, some huge number of watts. It's a pretty big light bulb. This is the fraction of that light that we get here at Earth. It depends on the surface area that's going to intercept that light divided by the larger area that that light is in fact uniformly distributed around. Now, the Earth is not perfectly reflective, or excuse me, it's not perfectly absorbing. So some fraction of this light will, so here's the Earth again, here's the sunlight shining on it. Some of it will be bounced off, particularly the white clouds, and so that isn't energy that we actually get. So the fancy word for reflected light is albedo. So something that has a high albedo is something that reflects a lot of light, like this white piece of paper. Something that has a low albedo is something like coal or this blackboard that doesn't reflect much light and so it looks black. So the fraction that we're actually going to get, that we're actually going to absorb, is going to be 1 minus the albedo of what we have a chance of absorbing. Okay? So this is the heat. That's the furnace. So why do you have to turn on your furnace more than once, right? That's because heat is leaking out of your house. So you have to add energy on the inside to match what's leaking out from the outside. So the same thing is true of the Earth. The Earth is sitting in a vacuum, which you might think would be a really good insulator, but it's constantly shining because it has a temperature. And so there is power leaving the Earth. How much power is leaving? Well, it depends on the temperature of the Earth. That's what we've been trying to calculate. And it depends on the surface area of the Earth. And it turns out there's something called the emissivity. Not everything emits equally well. So things that emit perfectly are called black bodies. It turns out that black things not only absorb light pretty well, but they also emit light pretty well. Things like shiny surfaces, like metals, turn out to have a really low emissivity. And of course, what has to happen in equilibrium is the power that we're getting from the sun has to be matched by the power that we're emitting ourselves simply because we have a temperature. Okay, so what have we got going then? Well, notice that the radius of the Earth cancels out. So it doesn't matter whether you're a rock or a dust particle, it's going to have the same temperature. So sigmas also pretty much go away. We can get rid of those four pi's, and we can get rid of that pi. So what we're left with then is 1 minus the albedo, the temperature of the sun to the fourth power, and then we have the radius of the sun squared divided by our distance from the sun squared. That all has to equal the emissivity of the Earth times the temperature of the Earth to the fourth power. Oh, I left a 4 behind, didn't I? Lots of things canceled out, but this 4 didn't. Okay, so we can rearrange this equation if we want by taking the fourth root of it. Oops. So if I take the fourth root of it, all I'm going to get is temperature there. So what I'm going to be left over with is the fourth root, which is usually denoted like that, 1 minus the albedo divided by the emissivity of the Earth. The fourth root of the temperature of the sun is just going to be the temperature of the sun. And then I have the fourth root of something squared, so that's going to be the usual square root of the radius of the sun divided by 2 times the distance from the sun. So let's check to see that this makes sense. If we are close to the fire, if we're at a very small radius, then we're going to have a high temperature, right? Small numbers in the denominator give us big overall results. If the fire is hot, or if the fire is physically big, either one of those things is going to increase the temperature of the Earth. The color, whether you're wearing black or whether you're wearing white, that's in this albedo. So if you're black, you have an albedo of 0, you have the maximum possible temperature. If you're shiny like copper, then you have an albedo that's nearly 1. And then, which case, the temperature is going to be correspondingly lower. Okay, so what we've calculated is the so-called surface temperature. So this would be the temperature of the surface of a rock. It would be someplace in the atmosphere of Jupiter. It's kind of a mix for the Earth. It includes some of the surface of the Earth and some of the atmosphere of the Earth, but at least gives us a handle on what the temperature would be for an object. Okay, and pretty clearly, it's the same sun for all of the planets. So for the planets, the big factor is going to be the distance we are from the sun. So generally speaking, the Jovian planets are going to be cooler temperatures than the terrestrial planets. The albedo plays a smaller role, but it does play a role. Turns out that the fourth root means that things don't change as much as the number that's inside the fourth root. So the albedo can change by a kind of a noticeable amount without having a big effect on the temperature, but it can have a effect on the temperature. So it turns out that Venus is way shinier than the Earth is, and if you calculate the temperature of Venus using this formula, you actually get a cooler temperature than you get for the Earth. Now you may know that the surface of Venus is super hot. It's way hotter than the surface of the Earth. And that's because what we're calculating here isn't the temperature of the surface of Venus, it's the temperature of the clouds on Venus. Remember, the clouds are thick on Venus. It has a huge atmosphere. So it's no contradiction to say that the cloud temperature on Venus is cooler than the temperature of the Earth. The surface temperature can still be way hotter. And of course, the same thing applies to all of the Jovian planets. It's way hot, thousands of degrees hot at the center of those Jovian planets. The surfaces are relatively cool. Okay, so this was all supposed to try and explain why the terrestrial planets don't have the most common elements in the universe as a key component of their atmosphere. Hydrogen and helium are relatively rare on our planets, but they make up the vast majority, 99%, of the material that's in the Jovian planets and the sun. So what role is temperature playing in all of this? Well, let's go back to escape velocity. And let's also remember, as we talked about repeatedly, that the mass of an object doesn't affect the trajectory. So if I take this piece of chalk and I throw it up at a particular speed, it goes just as high as if I take 100 pounds of lead and throw it up with that same speed. Right? Mass doesn't affect the trajectory for the case of gravitational force. So that's why this is a velocity. It doesn't matter what the mass is, it only matters how fast it's going. And we also know that temperature determines the kinetic energy of the particles. The higher the temperature, the faster they're going. So roughly speaking, the temperature, I could put in some, should I put in constants? Well, there's another one of these universal constants. It's called the Boltzmann constant. All these are famous dead physicists. So the Boltzmann constant, turns out that that is approximately equal to, got it, 3 kT. I don't really care about these constants. The kinetic energy is determined by the temperature. The more temperature, the more kinetic energy. And if we just rearrange this, what we get is the velocity of the molecules of air in this room, for example, depend on the temperature divided by the mass. The higher the temperature, the faster they're going. How fast are they going? Pretty much the speed of sound, right? Something like 1,000 miles an hour in this room. So you're constantly being bombarded by little bullets that are going comparable to the speed of the bullet of a 22, for example. But they don't weigh much, so they don't do a lot of damage. But they are moving pretty fast, but not nearly as fast as what's required to escape, right? That's 25,000 miles per hour. But if the mass is small enough, they're going a lot faster. So for the case of the lowest mass things on the periodic table, I guess my periodic table isn't up anymore, right? Hydrogen and helium, their mass is small enough that they have the ability to escape from all of these terrestrial planets. But the escape velocity is huge for these Jovian planets, so they don't have a sufficient velocity to escape. And obviously, if you just have a rock that's sitting in space, the escape velocity is very, very, very small, so they're not able to retain any atmosphere worth talking about at all. Right? So that's pretty much the case with Mercury. It has such a small escape velocity and such a relatively high temperature . So here's the escape velocity for Mercury. It's roughly speaking half the escape velocity for the Earth. And of course, it's hotter on Mercury than it is on the Earth, given that it's a small fraction of the distance that the Earth is. So for Mercury, even things like carbon dioxide and nitrogen and oxygen, things that we can retain in our atmosphere, Mercury can't retain in its atmosphere. The escape velocity is low, the temperature is high. Okay, so only in these outer planets where it's cold enough can we retain what is mostly what the universe is mostly made out of, namely hydrogen and helium. And they have retained it, aside from Pluto, which is pretty small, has a pretty small escape velocity, and presumably isn't retaining anything, even though it's very, 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 well, to say it's not retaining anything is turns out not exactly right. So you remember that the eccentricity of Pluto's orbit is unusually large, and in fact, Pluto goes inside the orbit of Neptune, and in fact has just recently been inside the orbit of Neptune. So when Pluto was inside the orbit of Neptune, we saw kind of a haze surrounding Pluto. And so at that time, presumably, solid nitrogen evaporated a little bit and gave Pluto a little bit of an atmosphere. And presumably, as Pluto moves out, that atmosphere will recondense on the surface of Pluto. So basically, Pluto doesn't have an atmosphere. Do they say it has an atmosphere? Let's see. Does it have a question mark? We actually have some idea of what that composition is. It says temporary, which is correct. Yep. Comes and goes. Questions? So people talk about the cold of space. Doesn't seem so cold. What's particularly cold about it? Well, so just as is the case with Venus, but to a much lesser extent, the temperature that you would calculate using this formula for Earth turns out gives you a temperature that's below freezing, not hugely below freezing. But the temperature on the surface of the Earth, of course, is on average above freezing. And that's, of course, because we've got a blanket on, right? We've got not a thick as blanket as Venus has, but a moderately thick blanket. And so the temperature on the surface is not the temperature that you get if you go up 10 kilometers, which is way below freezing. The surface temperature on Earth is above freezing because of this blanket that we're wearing. And that's something that I don't want to try and talk about today, but at least want to get the name up there. That's the greenhouse effect. And let me go, I guess, at least this far to comment about the name greenhouse effect, which is an unfortunate name. So you know that, generally speaking, greenhouses are warmer than the outside. And the usual explanation that you might read about is because of the properties of glass. So you know glass is transparent to visible light. So the visible light of the sun, which is actually a small fraction of the total light of the sun, but the visible light of the sun can get through the glass. When it's absorbed, all the light that is being produced by all of this stuff, that's all infrared light, and the glass is, opaque is an overstatement, but partially opaque is, I guess, a good word. It's partially opaque to the infrared light. So the infrared light is, in some sense, trapped inside the greenhouse. So that's a nice story until you learn that lots of greenhouses are made out of plastic, which don't have this property of glass, and they work just as well. So greenhouses don't really work on this property that they're often reputed to work on, of glass. They mostly work because they keep convection from happening. That is to say, we've got winds that are blowing that stir up and mix together large fractions of the atmosphere, and that mixing is inhibited because this is in a closed container. So mixing, what's the $2 word for mixing? Convection. So this is all under the title of energy transfer. You have probably heard about convection ovens, and you may have heard about radiant heat. And I think conduction is maybe something that you have some idea of what's involved. So convection has to do with a way of transferring energy by getting some material, typically a fluid, hot, and then move the fluid. And so this is exactly what your furnace does, right? Your furnace sucks in the cold air in the room, it heats it up to high temperature, and it sucks it back into the room. Even more important is natural convection. Automatically, hot air rises, so we can get a situation where the furnace heats the air, which rises, and it's being cool air will then fall to replace it, and we can have an automatic cycle which doesn't require fans blowing the stuff around. So natural convection just relies on the fact that hot air is expanded air and hence is less air, and hence is less dense. So hot air, it rises because it's less dense, and it's less dense because it's expanded. Same mass in a larger volume. So this is pretty much how candles work. Turns out the candles wouldn't work in the space shuttle. So fresh oxygenated air is brought in where it can combust, and then the hot products of the combustion go out the top of the candle. Absent gravity, of course, there's no up and down, so the hot air isn't going to rise. So you don't have to worry about convective fires if you're in a weightless situation. So radiation is what we've been talking about. That's where we put the energy in light and let the light go. Conduction. So you remember that for a solid, what heat is a measurement of is kind of how much vibration there is of the solid. So you can imagine a stack of atoms like this, and if I sit and I shake the bottom one, because it's connected to its neighbors, they'll start shaking. Because their neighbors are connected to their neighbors, they'll start shaking. So if you take a solid and put the bottom in a flame, these atoms are going to get there shaking. We're going to end up with the ones at the top shaking almost as hard as the ones that are on the bottom. So we have transferred heat from the flame up this piece of copper to get the top of the copper hot. So in this case, everything else had something in motion, right? Here we had the fluid moving, here we had the light moving. In the case of conduction, there isn't actually material motion. Well, maybe I shouldn't use motion because there's vibration. There's no material transfer. It's vibration transfer. So the standard example of conduction is putting a spoon in boiling water, right? The bowl of the spoon will get hot because it's in the hot water, but the end of the spoon will also get hot. But obviously, no atom has gone from the bowl of the spoon out to the tip of the spoon. Instead, it's been vibration that's been transferred. And of course, convection itself is very much present in boiling fluids, right? You can see, if you look at it, you can see that something is rising up from the bottom of the pan. And therefore, something must be falling back down. So we have natural convection that is getting the bulk of the fluid hot. Okay, so I've been talking generally about planets. Pick up maybe a little bit more specifics next time. Let me comment kind of about the future. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about the Earth because the Earth is the planet we know about the best.
Been meaning show you.